Nothing like a light topic like psychopathology in the little children.
You always know it's going to be a doozy when she comes in singing.
Kids who kill or they don't kill, they're just psychopaths. Welcome to our show.
Today on the show.
Kids who kill. Just kidding. They don't all kill. They're just, some of them are just psychopaths.
Yeah, we're talking about child psychopathy, which, I mean, I'm sure what brought you into the episode was the ones who kill. But also, Kathy will get into the nuance of that. Maybe, how they don't all kill.
Maybe it was my song that brought them.
Maybe you have personal experience as a child psychopath that you can share with the people.
I certainly have sat with a couple that I believe are.
As have I.
Yes, I know you have because you work with more littles than I have. And I will also want to hear from you. I know that I'll be kind of leading this episode, but I also want to hear from you, your experiences of how you knew and just what you felt like you were sitting with, mm-hmm. because it's apparent, mm-hmm. right? We've done episodes on the show around films that I think have done really good depictions. So if you've never seen the show or the movie, We Need to Talk About Kevin, after you listen to this episode, if you feel like you want a good example of what it might look like, I do feel that that was one of the closest.
Yeah, absolutely.
To what it would look like. So first of all,
he was pretty, yeah. They do a little bit of like the growing up part of him and seeing what mom saw and how he was experienced as a kid. And then most of the movie is, of course, he's a teenager, but
yeah,
they do a little bit of the,
they definitely show him and his restricted affective range.
Yeah, you bet.
That he kind of shows up like Damien from The Omen.
Yeah. Which is also a good example.
I would think that Satan's child would be a sociopath, psychopath.
I mean,
yeah,
you'd think they did that right then.
Well, let's say, I actually want to make a distinction here. I was reading an article in the LA Times this morning. The woman's name, I think it's Patrick Gagné. She's a self-proclaimed sociopath, and she has written a book that talks about how like not all sociopathy is bad or dangerous. And to me, I'm like, well, it depends on how you define dangerous, because right. They may not all kill, but
interracially,
certainly
interracially. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interrelationally,
they are incredibly dangerous, I think. So it depends on how you define danger. But after reading the way that she described herself, I was like, you actually sound more like a psychopath than a sociopath. So I want to make a distinction here. So how do we even define psychopathy? And, you know, we interchange these words a lot. And depending on how you, like where you sit in theoretically or what you've read, they do overlap, but there is a distinction. So first of all, the term psychopath isn't an official mental health diagnosis, right? It's a layman's term, and it's used to describe a cluster of characteristics and behaviors that indicate someone's callousness. They lack affective empathy, genuine remorse. They tend to be very deceitful. In the current psychiatric terminology, the pattern is generally known as antisocial personality disorder. But if someone also has what we call psychopathic traits, then it's kind of like antisocial personality disorder amplified by mm-hmm. X amount of traits. And we're not going to go into this today. We've done other episodes talking about Harris psychopathy checklists and how someone with antisocial personality disorder, if they score high enough on that, then they probably fall in that range of being a psychopath. We have two different types of psychopathy. We have primary and we have secondary. So when I was reading this article, and this woman's an adult, so it's relevant, but not completely to the episode today, but just when I was reading it, it felt more like she was actually describing a psychopath. Mm, okay. So someone who's callous, unemotional, manipulative, deceitful, doesn't really understand emotion. She's had to sort of mimic emotion. She doesn't envy people with feelings, but she's kind of enamored by the fact that people have more of like a color palette, I think is the way that she was describing it. She is married. It'd be interesting to know who he is, her husband, because she was talking about their marriage, and like either he is too, or he's just completely unaffected by her lack of anything. Mm-hmm. And then we have secondary psychopathy, which is what we typically associate with sociopathy or sociopath. So this is someone who has a stronger association with the diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder and some overlap with primary psychopathy. So sociopaths tend to be the ones who are more reactive. They tend to be more narcissistic. They tend to be more antisocial, meaning that they will go out of their ways to break laws. Ted Bundy is a great example of a sociopath, right? Where James Fallon, like we've talked about on this show, who's a neuroscientist and self-proclaimed psychopath, just more intellectualized about it. Doesn't mean that he wouldn't have the ability to be dangerous, but it's not really as driven as it might be more in somebody who's more sociopathically oriented. So,
well, in early childhood experiences.
And early childhood experiences, that's right. So there's a little bit of a distinction, but there is some overlap. So today we're going to be talking more just about psychopathy, which is these might even be children who never act out dangerously, but they lack an emotional affective range. They tend to be very callous. Some of them might end up becoming more antisocial and sociopathic. Some may not. Mm-hmm. Okay. Where it gets difficult is children cannot be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy until the age of 18. Well, they can never be diagnosed with psychopathy. It's not a diagnosis, but you know what I mean? They can't really be talked about that way until the age of 18, where they then are legally an adult. But I would even argue to say that there's even personality developing well into the 20s. But we start to see things very early on. In 2013, the American Psychiatric Association included the condition conduct disorder with callous and unemotional traits for children ages 12 and over in its diagnostic manual, or what, you know, we call the DSM. It's a serious condition that reflects interpersonal deficits, and it can be linked to harmful behaviors, but not always. I would argue to say that it at the very least links to emotionally harmful behaviors. Mm-hmm. Because most neurotypical people who end up in relationships of some kind with them will be affected. Mm-hmm. If because they feel.
Yeah.
Right. But not all of it is linked to physically harmful behavior. So not all people who fall under this label are vicious killers. Not everyone's going to go out and have a serial murder.
No. Yeah. We talked about that in a couple of the different episodes. Mm-hmm. Recently. The one I did with serial killers from the 70s to the 2000s, we had a conversation about that, because there's a lot that goes into the early childhood experiences that informs that brain, right?
That's right.
It's like, yes, it's in the brain, but it has to, the switch has to be tripped with a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Do the killer part.
And then certain other variables,
yeah,
come across their path where they're like, I need to get rid of this person, or it would feel, yeah, really good to take out aggression on this person, or this person reminds me of somebody.
Sure.
You know, Hollywood likes to create it this way because it makes a much more interesting story. But many psychopaths, if not most, actually do not engage in physical harm or serial killing unless, like we were just saying, a situation presents itself and the harm is really the only way for the person to meet their end goal or to get out of a certain situation. So
that's why they are among us, Kathy.
They are among us. And they are.
That's why a lot of the books are titled that. You know, a lot of the colloquial books that people read are like, you know, Sociopaths Next Door and,
yeah,
The Psychopaths Among Us and those kinds of books. It's because those authors are really trying to say, like,
they're everywhere.
They're not the Ted Bundys or the Richard Ramirez's that you would never have dinner with.
No.
Like, he's just too odd. You'd never have dinner with that guy. But no, these are the people that you'd have dinner with and that are your friends.
Yeah, I mean, there's another
or your
book
bosses
that came out a while ago by her alias, which is like M.E. Thomas, I think it is, and the Sociopath Next Door, or was one of those.
Yeah.
And she disguises herself, but writes her experience as a sociopath, which was interesting.
Yeah, it's good.
So due to this lack of empathy and remorse, what we will see is psychopaths push boundaries. They exploit other people and they have a tendency to feel understimulated and bored. So we see this early, early on with children who have this conduct disorder that I was talking about. We might see this as externalizing behaviors in school, or we could see that with like them acting out physically on animals. So they're going to engage in reckless and risky behavior because they need to feel something thrilling. There's been some really interesting research done on drug abuse or drug use with psychopaths and how their reason for using drugs is just so incredibly different from someone who's neurotypical, and how the addiction piece works so differently. I'll see if I can find it. Maybe we'll talk about it on one of our mini casts, because it's very, very interesting. And I was reading, someone had written their experience as a psychopath using drugs and how the drive to use is very, very different. Anyway, that's an aside. They, you know, they're going to engage in this reckless and risky behavior. They don't anticipate consequence and they think little of it if they do. So what we know about psychopaths, even from an early age, even children, is that they're wired, their brains are wired differently. So they lack that fear response. So they're going to do things to get a thrill because their brains don't feel that rush like we do with the simplest things. So they're going to push, they're going to do things. And rather than engaging in maybe more productive adrenaline rushes like skydiving, mm-hmm. or, you know, extreme sports. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're like, I'm going to kill that cat.
Right. And right? Usually it's just animals because it's easy, prey. But a lot of times I think nowadays it's younger kids. It's kids that are weaker around you, or kids that aren't as smart, or kids that are vulnerable. And these kids end up being covert bullies or outward bullies.
That's right.
They're often covert is what I see a lot of.
I think so too. Yeah.
Insidious behavior, manipulative, and then isolating them. And, you know, like the stuff you would expect from a psychopathic personality.
And we see it early on. Like we can say, oh, I saw that early on with this mm-hmm. child. We were seeing things. So sometimes they can be really organized. Sometimes they're completely impulsive and disorganized. They can be delusional. If they're more sociopathic, you can have like a narcissistic quality about them. But if it's a psychopath without heavy narcissistic traits or whatever, they may not care about how they're perceived. They're going to risk the reputation to get their needs met. And sometimes we'll see this with little kids who you're like, I can't believe they just did that. They don't even care what people think of them. Unlike a narcissistic personality who will like literally die on the hill of image to protect their shame and insecurity. So many psychopaths are indifferent to this, and some folks kind of dip their feet in both pools. So how does this all start? You know, the episode today is really about kids. So what might we see in a child psychopath? So genetics can play a large part. I'm interested to explore, again, not today, because I would digress and go into something much larger, but
go on into the ether there, Kathy.
What we know about certain genetic predisposition to things is, you know, the concept of epigenetics, right? Which is like our environment and what our predecessors in our lineage did before us to sort of mutate a gene. So, you know, for example, we know that historically, our bodies have been constructed to tolerate certain things or need certain things based on going back all the way to like caveman days, right? So I've always been curious because they talk about genetics can play a large part in psychopathy, but I also wonder how much intergenerational trauma also affects like the structuring of the brain. And I know that we've also looked at studies like this around drug and alcohol addiction. Like is alcohol abuse actually a gene, or is it really just a consequence of intergenerational trauma? They are related, mm-hmm. but we know with psychopathy that kids who generally have it, there's either been someone in their family. I know James Fallon talks about having people in his family.
Yeah.
Not all psychopaths have horrible upbringings
right.
either. No. So it's interesting.
No, and that's what we're talking about. Like, if you're wired that way, there's so much that contributes to then, you know, becoming the proverbial serial killer psychopath. You know, it's there's so much trauma. There's so much cognitive or developmental delays that can happen. Then trauma, then who your parents are, then who your grandparents were. Then if there's any kind of corrective experience, how smart you are. Are you good in school? Are you athletic? Are you like, do you get, is there any adaptive things that you do well? Like there's just so, where do you live?
Yep.
Socioeconomic status, culture. Have you been oppressed, sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, you know, gender dysphoria, like anything that possibly cause you stress in the culture is going to affect it too.
We have what Shannon's talking about is like protective factors versus risk factors, essentially. And then also your cognitive framing, because if we look at a lot of serial killers who are white males, they may not have had that level of oppression, but there may have been messages around what they're entitled to.
Yeah. Or they live in isolated existence in the middle of the woods in a very small part of the country where they're isolated from other ideas, other cultures, friends, healthy interactions, socialization, good schooling, like all the things, you know?
Yeah. So what we also know is that the younger a child begins to demonstrate these callous and unemotional traits, it's believed that the prognosis is not as good as it would be for someone with a later onset who might be just reacting to puberty. So we have two different onsets for conduct disorder. We have a childhood onset. We have an adolescent onset. What we know is that historically, the younger it starts, the prognosis is more dire because it's believed that it's much more ingrained and there's already been a lot of trauma and damage versus a child who's like demonstrating these traits because they're in the midst of hormones and puberty and these things. And so once they get through that, they've already demonstrated a relatively stable childhood and this is more circumstantial and they may actually, you know, if they're given the right intervention, can actually move on from it. So this is where that argument comes in, right? Well, like he's too young to know. Oh no, that's the worst time.
Yeah, there's a lot of new research and I don't know if you're going to get to this, but because it's kind of slightly off topic, but it's like there's a lot of research being done around can we diagnose earlier because there are a lot of emerging psychology experts that are wanting to lean into this and see if there can be early intervention. And the way our mental health system is, just like the medical system is set up, is if you don't have a diagnosis, you can't treat.
Right.
One follows the other. So if we can't if our diagnoses are ineffectual, which, you know, psychology has a couple of areas where we're pretty ineffectual. We don't have great diagnoses for trauma.
Trauma in the DSM is shit.
We're not there yet. You know, they're working on it, but we're not there yet. There's a lot of treatments coming out. But again, if you can't have an effective diagnosis, it's hard to get effective treatment.
Well, almost too many treatments.
Yeah. And so one of the things I would say is that Kathy and I, but we as a collective profession, they're trying to get an earlier diagnosis because we do have things, because hair psychopathy checklist, we have a youth checklist from 12 to 18. You can do the checklist.
That's right.
There's a youth one. You can do it. You can establish the traits. You can see that. And it has a lot of research behind it and blah, blah, blah. So there are things that we can do to diagnose, but we just don't. And so now what we have, as Kathy knows, is you have oppositional defiant disorder that leads to conduct disorder that leads to antisocial disorder. And that's what the conduct disorder and ODD is kind of what we have in the kid realm. And
absolutely.
Those are just like people who look at that diagnosis on your chart. If it's conduct disorder, they go, oh. If it's ODD, it's very, very common.
Yeah.
At least in my work, it's very, very common. But once it moves to conduct disorder, then it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Cause I've also known ODD kids who are just really anxious and they.
Yeah. ODD is different.
It's different, but it's
the precursor
related.
Still.
Yeah.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Mm-hmm. And so to, yes, I'm not going to go into specific research, but to piggyback on what you were just saying, Shannon, a 2016 study conducted by researchers at the University of Michigan suggests early signs of psychopathy can be seen in children as young as 2 years old. Even at this age, they show differences in empathy and conscience. So to what Shannon is saying is, historically, we haven't wanted to conceptualize children as psychopaths, but by avoiding what we might consider pathologizing a child, we are also getting in the way of early prevention. I think that we have to be able to have conversations about the fact that there's something wrong about Kevin, or there's not, you know what I mean? And I worked specifically with a child in my practice years ago where all these clinical MFTs and psychologists were like, well, maybe we just need to reframe the way we're working this token reward system and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, I'm like, is nobody else in the room want to realize that this is a budding sociopath?
And it was because they don't know what to do with that.
Exactly. So it
just makes everybody feel more hopeless. So they don't want to acknowledge it.
And it led to some pretty intense treatments that, now looking back at, I probably wouldn't have supported. But there was such little talk about what was actually going on. And I remember finally talking to someone and being very candid with the parents and saying, here's my concern. If this doesn't get better, we're looking at your child being in the system and hurting himself and possibly other kids. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you could tell in the parents' face that they didn't want to hear that, but they were relieved in the sense that I wasn't bullshitting them.
Yeah.
And that's hard for parents, but it was like, if we don't recognize this right now, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of this in the work that you do, and I want to ask you about that in a bit. I just think it's really important to note that when we're talking about this at a young age, it's not because we're trying to demonize a child. We have to recognize there's five things here. The study asked the primary caregiver, this is the 2016 study, the other parent and teacher daycare provider to rate callous unemotional behavior between ages 2 and 4 on the following items. 1, your child doesn't seem guilty after misbehaving. Somewhat subjective. And, 2, punishment doesn't change your child's behavior. 3, your child is selfish and won't share. 4, your child lies. 5, your child is sneaky and tries to get around you. Here's the problem for me with those five things. All kids lie. Punishment is subjective because there's discipline and there's punishment. To me, I would reframe that and say, does the child profit from experience through discipline? Because what we know about fear-based punishment, it's only sustainable in the presence of the fear. Once the fear is gone, they're like, well, I'm going to do whatever I want.
Yeah, it's all about the different kinds of conditioning, right?
So when I look at this study, I already find a lot of problems with it. Your child is sneaky and tries to get around you. Well, there's also a level of appropriate mischief for a child. So the way that they framed these to me can either, it oversimplifies, I think, what we're looking at.
It feels a little bit like they're trying to get some studies in the field that will be precursors to then when later they do studies.
Quite possibly.
And they can show, well, Kevin had this from 2 to 5. And then we did a hair, a hair checklist from 12 to 18. And we see these traumas and we see this behavior. We can see the mounting evidence type of thing. And then for kids in the future, we can then use this as a, well, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like you're sitting here reading this research, because basically what they did was
nice.
They followed up with these children again when they were 9. And they discovered that the children who exhibited the most conduct issues as a toddler or preschooler were more likely to exhibit these problems associated with psychopathy later in childhood.
Makes sense that that's what they were trying to
I think I just didn't like the framing of it because it felt so oversimplified.
No, I understand.
So a child with psychopathy exhibits similar traits to adults who have psychopathy. For instance, they may engage in harming animals, like we were talking about, attempting to kill animals for sport and excitement. Tweens, teens, and older kids sometimes engage in harming and killing of animals for sexual gratification. This often occurs in psychopathy conduct disorder and in antisocial personality disorder. The telltale signs of psychopathy involve disregard for others. That's really like the benchmark, and feelings and complete lack of remorse. So a lot of people, if you're going to go online and look at YouTube, this guy breaks down personality disorders. He's very palatable. Dr. Todd Grande. I love his videos because he's just like so to the point, and I think you can really understand. So he shared some insight into things that could be indicators. So he had 11 signs a child could be at risk of developing psychopathy. So one, which Shannon already talked about, conduct disorder with callous unemotional traits, limited pro-social emotions, puts someone at a greater risk at developing upwards of 20% of these children with the disorder. So if we're seeing kids, and if you're listening to this episode and you're thinking like, I've known kids like this, it's like you look at them and there's like a blankness. Mm-hmm. They don't look like they're feeling anything. Mm-hmm. So this first one is controversial, but it's the McDonald triad. So that includes bedwetting, arson, torturing and killing animals. It's like the 3-in-1, right? Mm-hmm. They also believe that the bedwetting, the reason why it's on there is because it can be related to trauma, such as, but Dr. Grande said, it's mostly problematic when we see children urinating on furniture and other children, which could be a sign of domination or aggression. So it's not just, you know, if you have a child and you're listening to this episode, oh my gosh, he's wetting the bed. That does not mean he's a psychopath.
Or he's harassing the cat or whatever.
Yeah. That's completely different.
I've known kids with psychopathic traits that love animals.
Absolutely.
It's a problematic triad because it's can be indicative, and but it's a little on the nose. It's a little blunt objecty for me.
Absolutely, because you're absolutely right. Some of them attach to animals.
Yeah,
actually,
it's like they only like animals because animals don't hate them.
Yeah, they're at their mercy too. Yeah.
Well, and they don't experience them as empty.
That's right.
And the rest of us experience them as empty.
That's right. So then we have stealing, cheating. With other children, friends, enemies, and even neutral parties. So that's a big warning sign, like if it's someone they don't even have beef with, right? Mm-hmm. Ignoring another child who is crying. So just kind of watching this indifference, right? Not being curious. Yeah, or confusion. They can't read the emotion, which is 5. Can't see the emotion in another person's face and recognize distress, which can lead to aggression. So we see this sometimes in Richard Ramirez, I think, might be a good example of, you know, he was very socially awkward. And if they misread someone's facial expression, they might act out aggressively out of paranoia, not knowing what that person is actually.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. And you just see a lot of incongruent responses. So people will think, oh, they have psychotic stuff because they're responding to internal stimuli, which is a thing you have to deduce, because sure, that could be something and you're going to couple that with other things, right?
Right.
Or it's they are misreading what's being said and the emotional quality of it, and then having an incongruent response, a socially unacceptable response to what someone else is saying. And so because they misinterpret it, which also can be all these other things, trauma, autism, et cetera. So like there's all these other things. And this is why, you know, I imagine people get very confused.
Absolutely.
Because it can be so many other things. But it's like that's what we always talk about, right? Is that there are constellations. So it's like any one of these things that Dr. Grande was listing, it's a constellation. Yeah. It's not just one.
That's right. This is where the ODD comes in. Dominance with authority could be a school teacher, a police officer. If a child has a weapon, this implies planning and intent. If they're also showing this, you know, just addiction to dominance, committing a crime alone. So sometimes we see kids do things together. They egg each other on. There's peer pressure. But when a child is more isolating and committing a crime on their own, desire to see disturbing stories or images. Sometimes they wish to be the cause of the death so they can see it take place. Number 9 would be fearless with consequence. They aren't afraid of punishment or physical pain. Fearless dominance, which is a trait of psychopathy. Motivated by reward, but not afraid of punishment. 10 would be bullying other children. Desire to create fear in another child. Understands fear as a construct, even if they can't read it in another person's face or maybe even feel it themselves. They understand that it's a thing. And they like playing with it, right? They use it. And then 11 is poor parenting, cold parenting, negative reactions to a child, highly critical, neglectful, emotionally unavailable parents.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of parent couplings that are sort of like someone with more borderline traits and someone with more narcissistic traits together, and their youth will sometimes have some of these issues and have sustained some trauma. It's interesting. One thing I wanted to add to what you're saying and what Todd is obviously saying is the other thing about the emotional reading of being confused or angered or what have you by other people's emotions. The other thing that I see in younger kids is confusion. And then I see curiosity. A lot of times I've noticed in a constellation of traits that around emotion, the younger kid will be curious about emotion, almost as if they're studying it. And what I read in that, again, with the other constellation of traits that I'm looking at for, like, okay, sociopathy or psychopathy, is they're really curious and they ask you a lot of questions about it and they don't really have an innate sense of it. Like they're studying it because, of course, as we know, good psychopaths... meaning successful psychopaths that go out into the world and are successful criminals, or simply successful in their psychopathy, in their industry, in politics, wherever they go, mimic. And so I see these kids, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, curious about emotion and studying so that they can then mimic. And that's the thing about working with folks, is that you're riding a fine line. And I think this is why a lot of clinicians really struggle or want to not look at it, is because everything you do is going to be suspect in a way, because you're either training them to mimic humanity better, which makes them more dangerous, or you're calling them out and pulling them into their shame and making them more dangerous that way. So I think a lot of times it's like clinicians are caught in the headlights, because it's like, if I do this, I'm helping train them to do better in society and possibly be more successful manipulating and, you know, being criminals. And if I go this way, I'm helping them be more in their shame and more violent now. Like, what? And this is where we get in the literature where it's like, then there's must be no treatment.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what I think the industry is kind of parsing out, is trying to figure out, well, which way. Okay,
where's the middle? Also depends on the person.
Of course. And it's also very specific.
Yeah. It's tricky.
But one of the things, you asked me a question earlier and you've already addressed it, but I would say without all the psychobabble stuff that we all are interested in, the one, I think the major quality that like my supervisees or myself will have when they're sitting with someone where they feel like there's traits that go in this direction, whether it's sociopathy or psychopathy or conduct disorder or whatever, because of my orientation, how the therapist feels is very important. And it is a piece of the knowledge around that person. My clinicians will say, who many of them are like deeply empathetic people, they'll say, I don't feel anything when I'm with that kid, and I don't see them feeling anything, and that's why I'm not feeling anything. And there's an emptiness behind the eyes and all of that. And then we start to have conversations around self and how a shattered sense of self can often be a very empty place to be, and not ever having built a sense of self, there would be an emptiness there. And you could only imagine if you were a kid who was empty.
Yeah.
And what that would be like and how you might act and how you might read other people complete. Like there's no mirroring. There's no like there's an emptiness there. Mm-hmm. And I would say besides all of the very clear signs, symptoms, behaviors, all of that, that's a quality that is consistent every time.
Yeah, it is. And I've even felt it with adults where this sounds terrible, but all transparency, I've felt like I've needed to take a shower.
Yeah.
When I've been done.
Yep.
That something was so ominous.
Yep.
And missing.
Yeah, because you can imagine if you're a therapist and you're trying to be in a situation where you're providing empathy and understanding and guidance and communion with another soul, another heart, another mind, and what you feel, because we need to attune to people, it's like a basic skill of therapy, you're attuning to that person, you're attuning to an empty space void, so to speak, a black hole, a darkness, something that's like, you know, air, wind sound. And then you come out of that and you feel either as if your stuff has been robbed because now you feel empty, or you were just in an empathic attuned state with something that was void.
Yeah. Or taking something from you, it can feel very intrusive.
Yeah, that's what I that's what I kind of mean. Like it's one or the other. It's like either you feel their emptiness, you're able to parse out that it's theirs and not yours, or you come out of it feeling as if it's yours, as if they've robbed you of yourself.
For sure.
Or borrowed it, because as they get more sophisticated with adult people, which is what I think you're talking about, they're more sophisticated. And so they do mimic, they do rob you, they do suck out your stuff in order to mimic it later. Mm-hmm. And half of them say they want to be therapists when they come into the office.
Well, interesting enough, the woman that I was talking about earlier today that wrote the book, she was a clinical psychologist. So
yeah. So beware of us.
Beware of us. But, you know, makes sense. They want to understand
you bet.
Things. So
you bet. That curiosity.
So going back real quickly to the parenting piece, it's the chicken or the egg as well, because sometimes what will happen is a child will do everything to detach from feelings and not develop empathy, which the psychopathic traits in children can also lead to parents not being able to show up for the child, which we see a lot in that movie we need to talk about, Kevin, is the mother... It has a lot of guilt around really hating her son because she can't connect with him and she knows something's wrong.
And they often are very, very aggressive with their families.
That's right.
They attack their mothers usually.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I don't blame you, lady.
Yeah, I've seen that in my own practice. So does treatment work, which is something Shen was just talking about a moment ago. So we know that early intervention with most things, if not all things, is better. So if a child can adjust to society's norms, they have to do that. They have to be incentivized by a reward, right? Because punishment doesn't work for them. And most kids are incentivized by rewards anyway, not by taking something away. So, you know, if all of parents say, do I take away their PlayStation? I'm like, for what? That's not going to change much. That's not really where the emphasis should be, in my opinion. A child may not ever develop the empathy to prefer social norms, but might realize that if they act pro-social, they can benefit more. So I saw this, I would do this a lot with folks who, when I was working with sex offenders in outpatient care, I came to the realization that they may never not have urges. So then we had to find, what's the incentive for them to not reoffend? What's the incentive for them to be pro-social? Because they're not all of a sudden going to have this moral awakening and the desire to not rape or offend goes away. That's not how that works. So, you know, it's more about adjustment than a cure or an eradication of something. And then, you know, the real question is, are children born or bred to kill? And so even if a negative environment presents itself, can that alone cause a child to kill? There are several, I'm not going to go into all of these. These are some names of children who killed. Charlie Starkweather, Cindy Collier and Shirley Wolfe, Graham Young, among many. I'll just read. This is Charlie Starkweather. He was brought up in a respectful home or respectable home. Well-behaved siblings. He was the third of seven. In contrast, Starkweather's time in school was unpleasant because he was often teased and bullied for his limitations. He was born with a leg disformity, a speech impediment, and also suffered from severe myopia. The only place he excelled was gym class, and he began to bulk up as a result. With his newfound physique, Starkweather transformed from bullied to bully and went from the most well-behaved teenager to the most troubled student. By 1956, 18-year-old Starkweather was introduced to Carol Ann Fugit, who was 13 at the time, and the two quickly hit it off. Gradually, Charlie convinced himself that he had to become a criminal in order to gain money and respect. On December 1957, Charlie committed his first murder and at once felt euphoric and peaceful. The day after Charlie robbed and murdered his first victim, Robert Colvert, he admitted everything to Carol. This confession caused their bond to become even more intense. It would also lead to their mass murdering road trip. Charlie was 19 at this time and his girlfriend 14, and they carried out a two-month spree that inspired the film California and Natural Born Killers. So these teens strangled, stabbed, sexually assaulted, and shot 11 different victims between December 1957 and January 1958 across the state of Nebraska and Wyoming, including his girlfriend's family. The day of their final murder, the duo ran into law enforcement, and Starkweather's girlfriend confessed, resulting in their high-speed capture. Starkweather was sentenced to death by the electric chair 17 months after he was arrested. So you can kind of see an early trajectory of how environment and certain demographics about him, you know, and then kind of grooming a younger girl into doing this with him. And then it led one thing led to another. So, and there are a lot of different cases online. That's one of many, but just to give sort of like the beginning to end and the story of what they did together. It's really disturbing, but it's a thing.
It sure is. Thanks for that, Kathy.
Yeah.
Appreciate you. Appreciate the topic. It's always interesting to know what our kids are dealing with in our culture. Sure. And talk about psychopathy, because that's what we do here on the often.
That's what we do.
You want to sing on the way out? No.
Kids who kill.
God, help us. All right. Thank you so much for listening. This has been an episode of Terror Talk. My name is Shannon.
And I'm Kathy. Sleep safe, everyone.